This is Icon Art Radio with Bill Teeple, who that's who I am, and Donna Colby, who's to my left, and Alan Cobb here on my right. And we're going to discuss a topic that Donna brought in today. Go ahead, bring up the topic and we'll see where it goes.
Well, it was just when I was leafing through a magazine last night, there was an interview with an artist and he said, it's important to distinguish between your passion in your creative work and merely being emotional. And he didn't go into any more details on that, but it sparked a lot of thoughts in me about that difference. And so I thought that would be a good jumping off place for today.
Well, it brings up for me the most significant issue in for me as a teacher, because I have to teach. Well, I tell people that I do two things. I teach the language of visual expression, and anyone can learn the language of visual expression, that is to draw and paint and things kind of realistically, as anyone can learn French. But just learning French, this is the second thing I say, just learning French doesn't make someone a French poet. So I work on two fronts from the very beginning, the front of teaching the discipline and teaching what it is you have, when asked the question of what is it that's deep in your soul that's unique to you, your personal love and passion that you want to get out there. And what makes the difference between just a wildly passionate person, we might say, or an emotional person about things, and an artist, is that the artist is able to frame these feelings, these understandings, those things that they love, because the passion has to do with what you love. An artist can frame what they love and present it in a way where others can get it. So you can't just rave on and on about what you love in an emotional way, or even or just go on and on emotionally. You have to develop a disciplined vehicle as an artist that has techniques and skills, and you have to present it in a format that has some structure so that all those feelings that you have can have a home to live in. So it's a balance between structure and life moving in that structure, because without that passion, without that love and feeling and life itself, because this is the content of art, without getting life moving in the structure, then we have an empty structure, and that's when an artwork looks very boring. It looks like an architectural drawing. It looks like just an empty shell because there's
even
no life.
Even if the artist
it.
Has great virtuosity, technically,
oh yeah, and this is what
emptiness.
So I divide it up. I make people get really disciplined and really learn skill and craft, and at the same time, I want them to experience almost stream of consciousness flowing. In fact, I talk about watching their hand dance on the page without the intellect getting involved at all. Mm-hmm. And in the end, we want those two things to get married together. So I have a feeling that that's what this guy's talking about.
Yeah, I think so, because creative passion, it comes from a deep grounded place that has to do with what you were just talking about, developing all these skills. And also, even in addition to that, it's something more rooted in who you are at your deepest authenticity, rather than just some mood you're going through that day. And it's kind of like when we read poetry we wrote when we were in high school. It's often like extraordinarily embarrassing because it didn't come from that deep place. It came from some flamboyant teenage mood we were in that day, and we poured our soul in that context onto the page, but it was a passing
well,
mood.
And go ahead.
And maybe there is a value in that too, if you don't start thinking that in itself is really profound and your genius because you wrote it.
Well, and emotionalism in the context that he's talking about sounds a little bit like your mood of the day. And so you could feel one way one day and another day, another way the next day. And we all live with these kind of changes and ups and downs. But someone who is in touch with what they love, their passion, it's from a more witnessing point of view, and there's it has to be a continuity that carries through all the emotionalism.
Yeah.
It's an interesting juxtaposition of terms, really, because I don't see anything emotional about passion in the context that we're using it. Passion really means something about motivation. Mm-hmm. It means that you're compelled to do something and that you can't imagine not doing it. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't mean that you're agitated about doing it, and it has nothing to do with whether you're going to wave your arms while you're doing it or do it, you know, in a cold, calculated way. In fact, the style in which you do it isn't even related to the idea of whether you're passionate about doing it. And I think people, you know, use the word passion in another context to mean someone who it gets really excited about whatever it is they're expressing. And obviously that excitement leads to an energy in the expression, but it doesn't necessarily lead to a worthwhile expression. It may or it may not, depending on how much control they can add to the mix. And of course, that brings up, you know, the other side of the coin, which is how does control fit into it if we're constantly saying that you should get out of your own way? Because we're also saying you should have the skills, and the skills are acquired through practice and control, and then you apply them spontaneously, but not necessarily emotionally.
Yeah, not necessarily anything goes. And, you know, like Bill was relating passion to love of what you're doing. So in that mm-hmm. sense, there is that emotion to it. But like you were talking about, even that emotion can be not a state of excitation.
Right.
It can be some deep, quiet, abiding, just dedication to that path. And when you were talking about control, the thing that came to my mind was the art of dance, which to me is a very good example of how you really have to be in very moment-by-moment control of your body to be even the most free-form kind of dancer. And you can't just get out there and, I mean, you can if you want to just get out on a dance floor and move around to music, but to look like a Merce Cunningham or any of these other people who are just extraordinary dancers, it's the amount of control they have is phenomenal.
Yeah. It's always fun to watch, you know, tiny children on the dance floor who are, you know, they see the big people doing these moves and they sort of interpret them without knowing they're interpreting them. Mm-hmm. They think they're reproducing them, I'm sure. They just kind of flap around and spontaneously express the excitement of the moment. And yet, as beautiful as that is, what you're really admiring is the beauty of the spontaneity itself, not the beauty of the dance that
right.
they're dancing.
And their little innocent observation. I remember when Adrian was about 3 years old, it was hilarious. We would take her to various theater events in Fairfield as a little girl. And I remember two specific examples. She came home, we had seen a modern dance show, and she came home and very seriously, she's this little chubby three-year-old, she goes like across the, I'm sorry I can't like show this to the radio audience because you kind of have to see her little body, but she bent down in a sort of little crouch like these dancers had done and just sort of beelined in this graceful way, moving and undulating her across the room. And we just totally cracked up because she captured the mood of it entirely, but she was just this little three-year-old chubby girl and doing it. And the other one was she had seen an Indian dancer and she got some little bells and started, you know, her body understood what she had seen, but she had no skill to actually reproduce it other than in that mood. But it was a beginning, because mm-hmm. now she has the control to do those things and the training.
So it's always a fine line between spontaneity and inspiration and attempt to recreate something that you're inspired by and the limitations of one's technique and body to do that. There was a time when the emphasis was so much on precision of craftsmanship and technique and realistic representation in art, that like by the middle of the 1800s, that became the whole meaning of it. And the meaning that the artwork carried in terms of its subject matter was sort of like just sort of boxed in and stilted, stuff about very didactic kind of statements about morality and historical scenes and portraits and stuff, so that the meaning was not that stimulating. But what everybody looked for when they went to the salons, which you've been discussing, is this this degree of craftsmanship. And then the whole thing broke open, as we talked about recently, when the that group of younger artists, led by Manet, Cezanne, and Monet, and those guys started to say, wait a minute, this, we want to deliver a fresh, innocent, like spontaneous experience of life itself. It's much more what it's about than this precision craftsmanship. And then you had artists in the early modern period actually imitating the style of children and not, right, and leaving virtuosity aside. And yet, it took a degree of virtuosity for an adult to imitate the freshness of children's art, and it wasn't just imitating children's art. These images carried great symbolic and philosophical power at the same time. So there's a difference between the two sides here, and we're talking about a marriage of these two sides.
Yeah, exactly, because the skill of making a spontaneous line itself is a skill that, like the Japanese artists or calligraphers or Chinese painters can spend a lifetime learning how to make a fluid, spontaneous line that actually expresses what they want it to express. And if you watch a film of Picasso, let's say, making a line, it's just like your jaw drops, because the confidence and boldness of making this line of, let's say he's making in one fluid line. I had this little book one time called One Liners, and it was whole Picasso drawings of like figures and animals and everything, where the entire drawing was just one line, one calligraphic line, but it was like perfectly capturing a horse or, you know, a centaur or a man and a woman. And you could sit down and say, I'm going to make a one-line drawing.
And the film we saw the other night of about Henri de Toulouse-Lautrec, there was a self-portrait that he did, which they presented it as an example of him playing with trick photography in the early days of photography, because it showed him at the easel doing a portrait of himself sitting in the chair next to himself. But on the easel was a drawing of himself that was one line. It was just a profile of himself, and it was quite remarkable. It was really incredible. And when they first showed that picture, they just showed the first half of it. They didn't use it. They didn't let you see that it was actually a joke. And my attention went right to this line. It was very faint, kind of in the background, and not easy to look at, and they only showed it briefly. But it's a wonderful example, as you say, of the spontaneity of doing it with one line, because if you do that slowly and carefully, it doesn't, not likely ever to look any good. So he did it freely, but with this layer of control. You know, maybe it, as they say in, you know, more in sports, I guess, that, you know, it's the muscle memory that's doing it, not intellect.
Yeah, and it's with a willingness, like I'm sure you do with your students, of just doing it over and over and over again. All those beautiful faces you see by Matisse, where they're almost like cartoons, very few marks, and yet the expression is just absolutely perfect. He would do hundreds of drawings of the same model.
Yeah.
And then he would choose maybe two of them out of those hundreds that for him worked.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it isn't really that every time he picked up the pen or the brush,
Right, although clearly practice makes perfect.
Yeah, so Bill, when you teach your students how to strike this balance of structure and technique and spontaneity, what kind of ratio do you, or you know, how do you
well,
balance
because
this?
People come to me wanting to learn to draw and paint, the emphasis is on the discipline.
Yeah.
And yet they want to get, if they just stay there, they get stuck in these realistic copies, you might say, of the surface level of something, and it looks like, in fact, it looked like a painting.
Mm-hmm.
It looked like a nice surface level reconstruction of something we know as a painting. Mm-hmm. And so that's all comfortable and nice, and people walk in the door with the idea of learning that skill, just like learning to speak French. But everybody can see that there's something lacking.
Mm-hmm.
So I give them as much of that as, well, usually with the young people, they can only handle so much of that. The
right.
young people, let's say it's 50-50. With the adults are so stuck on some kind of coming up with a product that they in spite of themselves, want to keep doing this thing that's not yielding passion.
Interesting.
But the kids, they immediately get bored of this discipline stuff, and so I'll maybe a portion of the period have them work on a exercise, and then I'll give them free drawing, I call it.
Mm-hmm.
Or even I'll actually have people doodle, mm-hmm. if necessary, to free them up. With the adults, I've been known to have a workshop called Kindergarten Painting for Adults.
Hmm.
And it's probably the most difficult class for adults to take. And I've had people go through the whole 5 days, and they finally, see, the only success in this class is to get to that place in your head that a kid is in when they're 4 or 5 making art.
Hmm.
And it is very difficult.
Where you're not self-conscious,
where you're
basically.
Not self-conscious, you're not, and you're actually responding directly to your passion,
mm-hmm.
to bring it to this theme. The kids will have no problem making art, little kids, because they have art supplies and they know what to do with them. There's no intellect getting in the way at all. They see blue paint and a brush and they're putting blue paint on the paper that's there.
Mm-hmm.
It's so automatic and just, there's no question about it. This is a no-brainer. Woo, boom, bam. And they've got something that's totally spontaneous, and they've loved everything, they've giggled and delighted. And if they think of something to paint, like a horse or a cow or a star, they think, oh wow, a pink star! And
right.
there it is, you know. And adults don't act like this
yeah,
at
and
all.
Until
to get them to that, and I have tried, I mean, that's what the workshop's all about. And sometimes it takes 4 or 5 days for an adult to get in that place, but I found that it's like the most therapeutic course I've ever done.
Hmm.
Especially it's mostly women that are mothers and stuff, and they're all very responsible, and they have not had the experience of being in that place since they were 4 or 5.
Because it is 4 or 5, because once you're 6, usually you have some teacher who says, that's not the way you draw a house.
No, that's right. Somebody
you draw this box, and then you make a little triangle on the top, and these are the windows and the door, you know, and then all the little kids' houses look exactly the same.
Right, exactly.
I love the question of what are the proportions of force and freedom, or control and spontaneity, because to me the real secret of it all is that we don't even know how we open and close our own hands.
Mm.
And you can, at the same time that you don't know how you do it, you can also do it carefully.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can slowly bring your thumb and forefinger together until they just barely touch. But if you try to explain, or even just to understand internally, how it is that you actually move any of your fingers or limbs, you haven't a clue. It's something to do with intent, and then the connection between intent and action is a total mystery.
I had an experience yesterday at a picnic that's directly related to what you were saying. I've always wanted to know how to whistle through my fingers, you know, like people do at concerts and all. And so I just thought of that yesterday in this picnic and said to the people sitting around me, does anybody know how to do that, and could you teach me how to do that? And this one old friend of mine I've known for, and she's a very delicate woman who, you know, dresses in pastel colors, and I never thought, would have thought she was going to be the best whistler in the group. She goes, you know, puts her finger and lets out this loud, perfect whistle. And she said, you know, she knew how to do that since she was a kid. And she tried to teach me and show me, like, very specifically, you put your fingers like this and you put it against the tongue. I could not make even close to a whistle come out, even though technically I was doing everything. So there must have been some kind of innocent approach she had to learning that when she was a little kid. And I'm probably just thinking about it in too rigid a way or something, but, well, I just couldn't do it.
When I was living in Switzerland, we rode on the boats on Lucerne a lot. And one day we were on a fairly large boat. In fact, it was the Gotthard. It was a huge boat. And there was a young man learning how to pilot the boat. And they had a little pilot station up on the side of the boat. And we would we'd come into the dock, and they're at the next town on the lake. And you'd see him looking over the side, and he'd, you know, slow the boat down a little bit. And then the guys down on the dock level would throw a hawser over the post, and then the pilot would, you know, go astern one quarter for 2 seconds or 2 moments or something like that, and the boat, it wouldn't get it right, and the boat would just keep on going forward a little too much, and the rope would pull taut, and the guys would step out of the way, and the dock would start leaning in the whole lake, and all of a sudden there'd be this loud snap, and the rope was like popped in this cloud of fiber. And he completely missed it. And so then they'd pull the boat in manually. And we'd get to the next town, and he did the same thing. We'd get to the third town, and he did the same thing. They had run out of rope, so they were now using these big nylon ropes. And when they pop, they make a really loud bang, and there's this big cloud of blue plastic shreds in all directions. By the time we got to the seventh or eighth town, they were using steel cables, which do not break, but they do threaten to rip the dock off of the mainland. Mm. And I realized that here I was watching someone docking the boat, stopping and starting it intellectually. Mm. He was following some book that says, with a boat this size, you know, you go astern one quarter for a count of three, and then ahead 1/8 for a count of two, and then astern 1/8 for a count of one, and that's it. And unfortunately, it wasn't working. And we realized that if you tried to explain to someone how to ride a bicycle, you'd be dealing with the same thing. How do you turn left? Well, you actually push with your left hand, and it starts to tilt the bike to the left, and that causes the front wheel to turn left, but you're actually pushing with the left hand as if to turn right, and that's how you turn left. Well, you know, it's completely anti-intellectual. There's no way you could possibly, you know, understand how to do any of the things that we do by explanations and analysis. You know, you get some idea of how it works and what the physics is, but doesn't tell you how to do it.
So did you work it out? Did you figure out how to dock the boat without?
Well, they gave up on this particular trainee, and because they were running out of ropes.
He's probably destined for another line of work.
I think he didn't have a feel for it, and that's the thing, it's the feel for it.
This raises the issue so perfectly of what we're dealing with here in making art and in functioning in life. And I'll watch students, or we all know of ourselves and others, when you enter a field, you have a passion or an interest in the thing, and yet what we do tends to be awkward. And then with time and experience, those who are even more awkward than others in the beginning start to get a feel for it. Mm. And before we know it, those people are graduating with that, and that's their field of life, and that they're very comfortable with that. Any activity that you learn, any sport, or, you know, if they stay with it a few years, suddenly they're the star quarterback. But there was a time when they were the bumbling beginner. And it's just what is it that's happening there that makes the difference between 1 year they're, from personal experience, I remember when Sandy Koufax couldn't throw a strike.
Uh-huh.
And I watched those games, and
yeah.
Aaron boo him and stuff. It was within a year or two, and he was the greatest pitcher of the time. He was a great strikeout artist, and mm-hmm. he was winning 30 games a year after year. I mean, the greatest. But a few years before, he was just another struggling ball player.
See, you can get a tiny little insight. Like, that exact thing happened to me with swimming. I wasn't a competitive swimmer, but I loved swimming, but I would get tired. I'd swim half a lap and I'd get out of breath. And it was so frustrating to me because I wanted to swim a long distance. And I actually learned this from a book. I was reading a book about swimming and it said, you have to blow out, like puff, make a little puff out when you're breathing out after you take a breath as when you're doing your crawl stroke. And because if you get out of the way, what makes you get out of breath is that you're not exhaling completely. And so, okay, I thought, all right, I'll try that. And the next day I got in the pool and tried that and went from not being able to swim a half a lap to swimming 175 laps without getting tired and feeling like blissful the whole time. Because it was just that one little misunderstanding or something I just didn't know about learning how to
swim.
So
this is the value of a teacher.
Yeah.
But I always feel that there's two things involved with learning. First of all, I say the person's got to figure it out for themselves one way or another. And a teacher can help you figure it out. But the teacher has to tell you the thing when you're right, ready to get it, mm-hmm. and you try it out and it works. If the teacher tells you something and then you're trying to apply it intellectually and it never gets experienced, mm-hmm. what it is that he's trying to get to you, it'll just go, you'll go on and on just missing it.
Well, and worse yet, if you tell someone something that in theory they need to know, because you're able to be a teacher in that relationship and you can see that they don't know it yet, if you tell it to them before they're ready for it, they may take it a step further. They may hear what you're saying, not understand its implications or its relevance, and decide that it doesn't work and it's a bad idea for now.
Mm.
And then later on, when they are ready for it and that someone presents them the solution a second time, they recognize it. And they recognize it as a solution they've heard before that was wrong.
Huh, interesting.
You've been listening to Icon Art Radio, a production of Iowa Contemporary Art, Fairfield.